Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 20, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm off with some friends and comrades celebrating the 21st birthday of my newsletter, Left Business Observer. I'm amazed at the thing's longevity, and it certainly has earned the right to its first legal drink. My association with WBAI is only about a year younger than the newsletter. Samori Marksman conducted an interview with me back around September 1987, my first time ever on the radio. I was terrified for the first minute or two, and then I realized I loved sitting in front of a microphone. 20 years later, I'm still loving it. And I can't hear the theme to this show without thinking fondly of Samori, who sublet me the Thursday night edition of his show, Behind the News. We've got two segments up tonight. First, in a few minutes, an interview with David Himmelstein, who is both a doctor and one of our leading analysts of the mess that is our healthcare system. David will be talking about Hillary Clinton's latest dream for reworking the thing. And at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Brett Benjamin, a professor of English at SUNY Albany, about his new book, A Cultural Analysis of the World Bank. Before we get to all that, an announcement, and then some words in the week's economic news. First, I've been asked to announce an event sponsored by the War Resisters League to honor the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition in recognition of their crucial work in defense of human rights. The event, Taking on the Torturers, consists of a cocktail party, discussion, and award ceremony hosted by WBAI's Deepas Fernandez. It will take place a week from tomorrow, Friday, September 28, at the Society for Ethical Culture, 2 West 64th Street in Manhattan, at 6 p.m. For more info, call 212-228-0450 or visit the War Resisters League's website, warresisters.org. Okay, now to the economic news. Last week, I noticed a rather strict demeanor on the part of our central banks in the face of a financial crisis that broke out over the summer, originating in the subprime mortgage market. Subprime mortgages, as you may all be getting tired of hearing by now, are loans made to people with low incomes or spotty credit histories, or both. Such loans exploded along with the housing bubble over the last several years, and now it's clear that millions of people are saddled with debts that they just cannot pay. Wall Street ignored that reality for a while, but it finally dawned on them sometime as spring was turning into summer, and rising anxiety turned into panic sometime in July. The panic moved beyond the mortgage market into a more generalized panic, with lenders increasingly shy about making loans. The danger is that if that attitude spreads and deepens and or persists, the whole economy could freeze up and we'd be facing a very severe recession. Over the last couple of decades, the financial markets have become convinced that whenever they face a bit of trouble, the central banks, like our Federal Reserve, will be quick to bail them out with deep cuts in interest rates and guarantees that nothing terrible will happen. This has worked many times, so many times that Wall Street began to say bailouts are bullish. That's a very risky proposition over the long term, however. If speculators think they're going to get bailed out en masse whenever they hit a wall, then that will only encourage them to take bigger risks on the next cycle. In the finance trade, this is known as moral hazard. If you're insured, why not be reckless in the pursuit of more money, ever more money? So as I was saying, the central bankers this time were making noises as if they were tired of this cycle of bubble, bailout, and new bubble, new bailout. They're going to put an end to moral hazard. Our Federal Reserve resisted calls to cut interest rates immediately before their regularly scheduled policy setting meeting on September 18th. Sometimes they make a policy move between those meetings, which occur every 6 weeks, but they're rare and only done in extreme circumstances. Their refusal to do so read like a cure for moral hazard. The most extreme position on this issue was taken by Mervyn King, governor of the Bank of England, who put out a statement last Wednesday that said that the moral hazard problem was so serious that he wasn't going to lead any bailouts this time. As King was making this statement, a British bank named Northern Rock was suffering an old-fashioned run. People were lining up outside branches, desperate to get their money out. Britain hadn't seen a run like this in a century. We haven't seen one in 70 years. In part, this was a mass panic. But Britain also has very weak deposit insurance compared to the U.S., so people really were worried about getting their funds out. Despite words about reassurance of the government, the run continued, until the British government effectively nationalized Northern Rock to guarantee its deposits. Mervyn King's bravado was proved hollow in just a matter of days. And then on Tuesday, our Federal Reserve cut the interest rate under its direct control by half a point. Though this was not entirely unexpected, they could have been chintzy and just moved by a quarter point. But they went for the bigger cut, and the financial markets rallied. A friend who works at an investment bank told me that a cheer went up on the trading floor when the move was announced. The masters of the universe can do no wrong, because if they stumble, there will always be a bailout. Maybe the cheering traders are in for a surprise. Maybe the Fed and its colleagues abroad want to prevent disaster, but also want to prevent the development of yet another bubble. And from the Fed's point of view, if it weren't for this financial crisis, they wouldn't be easing. The unemployment rate is still a little low for their comfort, and productivity growth, which was very strong from about 1995 through 2004, has been slowing down markedly. Weakening productivity growth means weakening corporate profits and higher inflationary pressures. None of that is good news for the financial markets over the longer term. Interestingly, after the Fed cut interest rates, the bond market weakened, meaning long-term interest rates rose. The Fed can only control short-term rates. Long-term rates are at the mercy of the markets. Gold prices rose and the dollar weakened. That means that the markets see the move as inflationary. It would be quite something if the Fed were looking to weaken the dollar and give a boost to inflation. That's one way for a country with big foreign debts, like ours, to ease the repayment burden. A weaker U.S. dollar would also boost our exports, since it would cheapen their price on world markets, and discourage imports, since it would make them more expensive. But inflation and currency debasement are often a sign of a country in trouble. It can be a semi-desperate move with bad long-term consequences. If the Fed is taking that route, then all the foreigners who've been lending us money will cut back on the flow, and our own financial markets may get alarmed and begin falling apart. It sounds a bit like the 1970s all over again, except without the labor militancy. That decade's stagflation, as economic stagnation plus inflation, was what eventually gave rise to the right-wing crackdown of the Reagan-Volcker years. It would be amazing if a heavily indebted U.S. were turning to an expedient strategy that drove big capital crazy 30 years ago, and one that is usually associated with basket case countries like Britain in the 1970s or Italy in the 1980s. Much more to come in the weeks ahead. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with David Himmelstein. And that was a bit of Call the Doctor by Slater Kinney. And that's just what I did yesterday. My first guest is David Himmelstein. David is a doctor who practices at Cambridge City Hospital in Massachusetts and a teacher at the Harvard Medical School. He's also the co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program and, along with his partner Steffi Woolhandler, is one of our leading analysts of healthcare finance. This interview was recorded yesterday. David Himmelstein. So here we are again. Hillary Clinton is offering a health plan. What are your thoughts on HillaryCare 2.0?
Well, she's caved into the insurance industry right at the start. She's offering a plan that promises to ship tens of billions of dollars in government money to the private insurance industry and keeps private insurance companies at the very center of our healthcare financing system. And because of that, it's extraordinarily expensive to try and cover the uninsured this way, and she can't really do much, if anything, for people who already have insurance. So people who are being bankrupted by their medical bills despite having coverage, she's offered essentially nothing to. It's a program which, even if she can pass it, won't work.
Let's step back about 15 years. What was HillaryCare 1.0 all about?
Well, she was proposing a complex system where people would be required to buy coverage, employers would be required to chip in for coverage for their workers, and there'd be a federal government agency that would help them purchase that coverage from private HMOs. So government would essentially act as a broker and as an enforcer to make the system work.
As I recall, you had a conversation with her where you pointed out that, what was it, with 70% in the polls and strong presidential leadership, we could actually get single payer? Is that right?
Yeah, well, I spent about an hour and a half, 2 hours outlining why single payer was the program that could actually work, because you save vast amounts on bureaucracy and insurance company overhead, profits, and the outrageous incomes of executives, and you can use that money to cover the uninsured without increasing health costs at all. And at the end of that, she said, well, that's a strong argument you make, but is there any force on the face of the earth prepared to go against the insurance industry and the billions of dollars it would pour into this fight? And I suggested the President of the United States leading a crusade of the American people, and she said, tell me something real.
So the power of the insurance industry is so great that the President and the majority of the American public could not resist them.
That was the implication that I took from it, surely.
Do you understand the source of this power? I mean, if there are certainly a lot of other industries that could save money. I mean, people often wonder why, for example, the steel and auto industries aren't embracing single payer. Do you have any thoughts on why they're not ganging up and resisting what is not the, by far the largest sector of the American economy?
I think there are a couple of things. One is it is a very large sector. I mean, they have annual revenues of about $500 billion. So we're talking about significant corporate power there. They also have a lot of cash they invest in other firms. So it's wrong to think of them as a completely separate sector of the economy. They're part of the overall financing of the auto industry and of other firms as well, because they're investing the money they get in premiums until they need to pay it out as benefits, and that's a big pool of cash to work with. Third, they sit on the boards and interlocking directorates with many of the other companies. So I think it's wrong to think of the corporate class as made up of separate and discrete companies with separate and discrete interests. So when you talk about the board of GM or the board of Aetna, you're talking about a fairly wide cross-section of people from different industries who come together in those kinds of things. I think the other thing that's going on here is there's firms like GM and Ford, even though they don't like paying for health insurance, they very much like the fact that if their workers go out on strike, they lose their health insurance, and that the alternative to having employment isn't just being unemployed, it's actually having your standard of living go way, way down. There's no social safety net, and it would tremendously strengthen the power of labor and the bargaining power of even unorganized workers if there was a healthcare safety net that's there whether you're employed or not. So they really don't want national health insurance for that reason.
This is getting a bit off track, but we do see kind of an interesting split in the labor movement that some of the service sector unions, predominantly SEIU, is kind of applauding Hillary and even Mitt Romney's plan and Schwarzenegger's plan in Massachusetts and California, whereas some of the old-line industrial unions are actually more involved in the single payer. Do you have any thoughts on the involvement of organized labor in this fight?
Well, I think organized labor has somewhat schizophrenic views along several lines. One is traditionally health insurance is something they've been able to deliver for their members that others can't. When you say, why should I join a union, a strong argument for joining a union has been, we'll get you health insurance. If you have national health insurance, that's no longer an argument for joining a union. Now, when it becomes a bigger and bigger problem to defend that health insurance, it becomes more of an issue for unions. So if you're competing against China or Japan, as the auto industry does, then the company says, we can offshore and get rid of our workforce here. And healthcare is one of the problems that's causing us to spend so much money. So it's more of a problem for the union to defend that. For service workers, it's very hard to offshore hospital work or nursing home work, so there's a little bit less of a threat that employers are going to take back that coverage and offshore the work. There's also the fact that in some unions, the management of employee benefits is part of what the union does, so the building and construction trades traditionally have gotten their health insurance coverage from Taft-Hartley funds, so the employer pays a certain amount per hour that each worker works into a fund, and that fund is jointly managed by the union and the employers. And that's been a source of union power and union jobs. You know, if you're a former union president, you might get a $100,000 a year job managing one of those trusts.
All right, let's get back to the political campaign. Mitt Romney immediately attacked Hillary's plan as and Giuliani, too, as like socialized medicine. But there seems to be a lot in common between what Hillary is proposing and what Romney did in Massachusetts. What are the similarities and differences in their plans?
Similar in that both would require people to buy private coverage, and similar in that both would require big employers to contribute at least something towards the coverage. The Massachusetts plan, that employer contribution is very small. Different in that Hillary Clinton would make a Medicare-like plan available to people to buy in addition to the private coverage. So you'd have an option of buying something like Medicare or buying a Blue Cross kind of policy. And that's not been one of the options offered in Massachusetts. But in a lot of ways, they're pretty close.
How are things working out with the Massachusetts plan?
The positive is that very low-income people have gotten some coverage because Medicaid was expanded, or a program very much like Medicaid. But the rest of the program is not going very well. For 244,000 people, they've essentially been told, go buy your own coverage, and, oh, we're going to set up a broker to help you find more affordable coverage. But it turns out the coverage that they're being offered is not really very affordable. For someone my age, you're talking about, you know, $4,000 a year or so. So the state says to you, you have to buy coverage. It gives you no help in buying it. And if you don't buy it, you pay a $2,000, $3,000 fine. In fact, thus far, not many people are buying it in that circumstance, and we'll see when the time comes to collect those fines what happens.
How is this fine supposed to be enforced?
When you file your income taxes next year, unless you check off the box certifying that you've bought coverage or that you've been excused from buying coverage because you filed for a hardship exemption, you pay the fine as part of your income tax return.
And what's the hardship exemption?
They've set up some figures for if you spend more than a certain proportion of your income for the coverage, you're eligible for an exemption, but you have to, in most cases, go and apply for it. So there's a fairly bureaucratic process to get it done. But up till now, only about 2% of people have actually gone out and bought the coverage they're required to buy.
So that still leaves an enormous number of uncovered people in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, we don't have current figures, but we think there are probably still almost as many uninsured now as there were before the bill was passed.
I'm speaking with David Himmelstein, who is a doctor based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program.
Let's talk about some of the other proposals that are floating around. The other Democratic candidates have their ideas. Edwards and Obama, what are they offering us?
Well, Edwards and Obama are offering something pretty similar to what Hillary is. Obama's been pretty vague about the details of his plan. I guess the big difference is that he wouldn't require people to buy coverage. He would offer the same kind of federal government subsidy to help people buy private coverage, but he wouldn't require it. Obama admits that doesn't get you the universal coverage, but that's the way he wants to go. Edwards emphasizes a little bit more the expansion of a Medicare-like program and making that available for people to buy rather than using the government as a broker for the private insurance companies. But again, he would let the private insurance companies compete with that Medicare-like coverage and would throw in subsidies. So I think it's fair to say that Edwards' proposal is quite close to what Clinton has proposed as well.
I would imagine that the private insurance companies would have a hard time underselling Medicare, wouldn't they?
Well, you'd think they would, but it turns out that it's easy to undersell Medicare if you get the healthy patients and they get the sick ones. And the private insurance companies have been underselling Medicare in the Medicare program, largely by going out and doing tricky things to recruit healthy people into their plans. 22% of over the age of 65 who are currently on Medicare cost Medicare nothing in the course of a year. And if you're a private insurance plan and you get those 22% in your plan, you've got a bonanza. And the way you do that, you know, you put your sign-up office on the third floor of a walk-up building. You recruit people at health clubs where they're exercising and have your sign-up at the front desk of the health club. There's a whole science to how you try and selectively enroll healthy people and keep sick people out of your plan. And that's what they've done in Medicare. That's what they do under Hillary Care or under Edwards' plan.
We hear competing claims. Some polls show that people are actually fairly satisfied with their health care coverage. Yet it does seem like a political issue that's always simmering under the surface that's about to get more salient, as the pollsters say. How do you read the politics of health care at the present?
Well, I think people most people are satisfied with their health care because they're not using it. Most people are healthy and they visit the doctor once a year, maybe twice a year, and that's it. And in that circumstance, the healthcare system doesn't work badly for you. But when you get sick, you actually experience the healthcare system, and then people are very dissatisfied with it. So what does that mean politically? It means that the polls show people are, quote, satisfied with their healthcare or their health coverage, but an awful lot of them are very familiar with the fact that a member of their family got in trouble, their mother, their father, their uncle or cousin. And there is a sense that's very widespread at this point that the healthcare system is in crisis and in rising crisis, and that something needs to be done about it. The surveys are showing it's the number one domestic issue. What does that mean? It means that politicians are going to be saying they're going to do something about it, and there's not a lot of clarity in the American people about what the details of what should be done are. Though if you ask them, they say they want single-payer national health insurance. That's the most popular option.
I was kind of amazed that Michael Moore's sicko didn't have more of an effect on the political discourse than it did. Am I missing something? Is there sort of a subterranean effect, or is this sort of passed by?
Well, I think there was some subterranean effect, but it's a movie. How many movies have changed the political climate by themselves without a movement around them and without longer-term political work? So I think it gave us a boost in the work for national health insurance, and we need to move beyond it and keep working with it.
You've done a lot of work over the years on the administrative costs of the U.S. system. Some of it goes back into the early 90s. So what's it like now? Are things getting even more expensive and more inefficient in recent years?
I'm even older than that, Doug. The work actually goes back to the early 80s. The latest data says that our administrative costs continue to go up, at least through 2005, and that as we've computerized more and more, we have not less but more bureaucracy and a higher proportion of our health spending going to administrative costs. That's both the insurance company overhead and the doctor's office bureaucracy and the hospital bureaucracy.
And these figures are always quite stunning, so let's review some of them. Just how expensive is this administrative burden, and how does it compare to other systems abroad?
Well, about 31% of U.S. health spending goes for administrative costs, as compared to about 16% in Canada. So about 15% of total health spending in our country is for administrative costs that we could get rid of if we moved to a single-payer Canadian-style system.
There is a bill in Congress with quite a few co-sponsors that would expand Medicare to as a way of getting towards a single-payer system. What do you think of that?
Well, I think H.R. 676, which is John Conyers and Dennis Kucinich's bill, and we should say there is one presidential candidate who's pushing for single-payer. That's Dennis Kucinich. It's a good bill. It doesn't just expand Medicare. It actually fixes the problems that Medicare has at this point. Medicare has been under attack from the Republicans for many years now, and they've managed to drive some wedges in there. So H.R. 676 is a good bill in my estimation. It's national health insurance. It eliminates the private insurers from the mix. It says no for-profit hospitals, no for-profit kidney dialysis centers, no for-profit nursing homes. We're going to make those not-for-profit because we know that the for-profits deliver inferior care at inflated prices.
Now we've got Alan Greenspan, now the latest person to be running around, complaining that we have to fix the Medicare problem. It's going to bankrupt us if we don't. What do you respond when people say that sort of thing?
Well, Well, I think we do need to fix the Medicare problem. The way to fix the Medicare problem is to include everybody in a Medicare-like system. You know, the Medicare at this point has a couple of problems. One is that the base of workers relative to the elderly is getting somewhat smaller, though the number of young people who we have to support is also getting smaller. And we'd fix that by enlarging the pool of Medicare to include both young and old and children as well. Second is that Medicare has some of the inefficiencies that our private insurers have. So rather than streamlining things when they started Medicare, our government adopted a Blue Cross-like model for how to run Medicare. Canadian hospitals don't bill patient by patient, Band-Aid by Band-Aid, aspirin by aspirin. American hospitals do. We ought to move to those more efficient ways of billing. That would save Medicare money, and it would save the healthcare system money. And we could use that to make Medicare sustainable and to cover everyone.
What about the political prospects? It does seem like an uphill fight. We, you know, when we Hillary Clinton says "be real," she means that there are just many obstacles, even with presidential support and popular support. How can we change that?
Well, organizing and actually working to change our country, and that is not easy. It's not a simple short-term goal, but it's doable. I'm old enough to remember when there was legal segregation in much of this country and when it looked like we'd never get out of Vietnam, and I remember when the professor of European history at Harvard said in a lecture that in our lifetimes we would never see Germany reunited. So major social changes happen. They don't happen easily, but they happen with organizing, with work, and I see no reason why we can't have change in our country as well.
And that was David Himmelstein. David is a doctor who practices at Cambridge City Hospital and a teacher at the Harvard Medical School. He's also a founder of Physicians for National Health Program, and along with his partner, Steffi Woolhandler, one of our leading analysts of healthcare finance. Let's take a break for Station ID.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
This is WBAI, which is not only in New York at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. Please do check out the website for our program schedule, background info on shows and producers, archives of our programs, and general news and announcements. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Brett Benjamin. That was a bit of offshore banking business by the members. Over the last few years, I've been trying to bridge some intellectual and political gaps through my writing and radio programming, between activists and intellectuals, and among the often separate spheres of economics, politics, and cultural studies. My latest effort in this area is an interview with Brett Benjamin. Brett is a professor of English at SUNY Albany, who is the author of the book Invested Interests, Capital, Culture, and the World Bank, just out from the University of Minnesota Press. The book views the bank not only as an economic and political actor, but a cultural one as well, one that has tried to assimilate the so-called Third World to the Western and especially American view of life, as consisting of the accumulation of capital and the consumption of material goods. Assimilate the Third World in a clearly subordinate role, too, of course. In this interview, Benjamin speaks of Fordism, a term that might not be familiar to everyone, so I should define it. Named after Henry Ford, it refers to the economic model of mass production and mass consumption that arose in the U.S. of the 1920s, but really went into high gear in the golden age of the 1950s and 1960s. There's still a lot of Fordism left in our economy, but the old regime of rising wages and relative security has been replaced by one of stagnant or declining wages and spreading insecurity. But that's a topic for another show. Okay, here's Brett Benjamin in an interview recorded on Tuesday.
So before we get going on the World Bank, I just want you to define a term that you use frequently that the audience may not be familiar with. What is this cultural turn?
it's important to my work for sure, and here I rely on the work of Michael Denning in particular. But I'm talking about a moment really historically grounded around the Second World War, when the very sort of theorizations of culture shift substantially. And so that prior to this moment, say 1945, 1944, culture comes to us through a sort of Matthew Arnold notion of high culture, arts and aesthetics, or a kind of anthropological notion of complex whole. E.B. Tyler is the reference I sort of stick to. And around the Second World War, really in conjunction with Fordism and the spread of Fordism, mass culture emerges, and mass movements, particularly in the national liberation movements of the Third World, from the point of view of my book, emerge, so that culture begins to be theorized in a fundamentally different way as a site of struggle, contestation, a deep, thick relationship between economics and culture, where culture itself is constitutive of subject, subjectivity, people, notion of identity and selves.
Now, there's no style of thinking that says economics and culture are different, that they're, if not opposed to each other, distinctly different. You're arguing against that.
Well, to some degree. I mean, I'm suggesting that at this moment, people begin to think about the two as more integrated, more deeply infused with one another. I'm not entirely sure that the sort of classic Marxist-based superstructure model isn't still applicable, but I think people begin to really think about the limits of that model. People begin to think about race, sexuality, gender, the production of collectivities that aren't simply about class based out of a particular mode of production, and I think that relationship is troubled.
All right, so let's now turn to the World Bank, which you think plays an important role in this turn at the end of World War II. Let's go back to the founding moments. It was initially a bank for reconstruction and then development, so those are the names in its title.
Right.
What lay out that sequence for us.
It's an amusing sequence in a way. The World Bank is founded at Bretton Woods, the same conference that sets up the IMF, and it's really something of an afterthought at Bretton Woods. It's fundamentally designed to be a reconstruction bank, that is, to fund the reconstruction of Europe after the war is over, the Second World War. And in the sort of a brainstorming session between some of the chief U.S. architects, they're thinking, well, what are we going to do with it after? And there's a funny moment of an exchange where Harry White just said, well, let's leave it there for after. We'll call it development. And so development sort of gets tacked on as something of an afterthought to the initial construction. And in fact, the Marshall Plan, soon after Bretton Woods, comes and kind of pulls the rug out from under the bank's reconstruction mission, and it's sort of forced to find itself, to define itself as a development agency. And this is the real struggle of its first, 30 years of its existence, trying to transform itself from something that looks like, European reconstruction into what we now think of as development, poverty alleviation, an emphasis on the developing world and the problems therein.
Yeah, the biggest borrower in the early days of the bank, of course, was Japan.
And right.
That reconstruction was relatively quickly accomplished in the historical sweep of things. And we're also talking about societies that had been industrial and rather affluent before the war. But then after that reconstruction mission is accomplished, it needs to shift its focus considerably, right?
Right, exactly.
So the bank also was born just about the time of the beginning of what we now call the post-colonial era. So
Right.
Work out that timeline first.
Post-colonial studies is a term that I try to engage with throughout the book. You know, I write from an English department, and that's the dominant term of our discipline in a way. So you know, you could potentially locate the post-colonial era from the independence of India, a few years after the World Bank. One of the things that I'm trying to suggest is that it may be useful to think of the World Bank era and the post-colonial era as overlapping. And the term that I use to think them through and to sort of link those two is this global cultural turn. In other words, if thought of not so much only in terms of the legacies of colonialism, but also in terms of the way in which a kind of financial logic emerges after the World War to sort of suture some of these rifts that have emerged, that transnational cultural studies may be a slightly more expansive way of understanding post-colonial, in part because a lot of the ways in which we think about post-colonial studies has been a pretty narrow group of mainly intellectuals from the global south that are now teaching and working in northern, you know, high-powered academies. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing is looking at some of the intellectual genealogies that go back to a lot of the anti-colonial national liberation cultural radicals of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and thinking about those as part of a post-colonial studies and part of a transnational cultural studies.
You have some vignettes of Keynes, who I think a lot of the liberal critics of official development, people like Joseph Stiglitz and Amartya Sen, whom you may name, sort of idealize the bank of Keynes's imagination as something maybe we should go back to because it's been hijacked by Wall Street and the University of Chicago kind of thinking. But Keynes himself was no angel, as you reveal.
Yeah, I think this is one of the interesting nostalgias of our moment that we long for some kind of, you know, liberal interventionism, but Keynes certainly had no internationalist leanings in the founding moments of the bank. He really wants this to be an institution constructed by an elite group of European and U.S. constituents, primarily for the reconstruction of those economies, and if it trickles down afterwards, great, but it's pretty clearly not his primary goal in setting up the bank. He refers to a batch of the signatories at Bretton Woods as these monkey house nations in a disparaging note that he sends to Harry White. And I think that kind of Eurocentrism is fairly deep-seated, you know, even if he's now become lionized in a way.
So almost immediately, the bank needs to sell itself to Wall Street because it needs to sell bonds to Wall Street.
Right.
And the early leadership, is concerned that it has too much of a New Deal giveaway feel to it. So
right.
Tell us how the bank went about selling its image to sell its bonds.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really interesting things about looking at the early years of the bank, which I think are left out of a lot of the critical histories that tend to sort of look briefly at Bretton Woods and then jump ahead to the McNamara era, is the you know, really radically 180-degree turn that has to take place before that McNamara era can really get going. The liberal interventionism that we now think of as sort of fundamental to the bank's mission, alleviating poverty, was not the case at all in those early years when selling bonds to you know, private investment to Wall Street is the you know, order of the day. The World Bank, unlike most other multilateral institutions of governance, is funded in part by government contributions, but most of its lending capital, especially in the early era, is taken in by securities investments from Wall Street. The U.S. dollar is the currency, the only currency strong enough after the World War to really do effective international lending. And so the bank, you know, hawks and sells and, you know, talks to audience after audience of bankers, investment brokers, and so forth, trying to drum up capital. And the way they do it is really by insisting on their absolutely fiscally conservative bona fides. Any project that will be a recipient of World Bank loans will be absolutely clear, verifiable, concrete, contained. No excess lending will be made, nothing outrageous, nothing speculative. The only thing we will lend for, we being the World Bank, would be projects that are clearly going to add to the productive capacity of a national economy and will produce returns in capital flow. And that shifts entirely after the 1960s, when a lot of the decolonized nations joined the bank. That fiscal conservatism is really turned on its head, and the World Bank has to begin thinking about social lending in a much, much broader scope, so that, you know, in bankers' logic, and you know, and the economist listeners, you know, of your show will be aware of this. The famous example is that if the World Bank funds a power plant that was already going to be funded, and the nation state that takes those funds creates a brothel with them instead, effectively the World Bank has funded a brothel. That logic escapes the kind of, you know, bankers, accountants, red and black notebooks. But in the 60s, this 180-degree shift takes place, where social lending for education, housing, sanitation, urban structures becomes the order of the day. And in those instances, what you're doing is lending for something that can't be verified. It's not clear how directly, you know, funding an education program is going to produce economic return. And this is the 180-degree shift that I think gets left out of some of the critical bank histories, you know, that jump ahead to the McNamara era.
I'm speaking with Brett Benjamin, who is a professor of English at SUNY Albany and author of Invested Interests, Capital, Culture, and the World Bank, just out from the University of Minnesota Press.
Let's step back into the 50s again, but for a moment.
Sure.
How did the bank think of what it was doing and sell itself to the world? Was it sort of trying to generalize a model of the American way of life?
Yeah, I think this is where the issue of Fordism and the export of Fordism comes into play. And by Fordism here, I'm really referring both to the model of industrial production, but also that broader social context in which Fordist production takes place, that is, the kind of development of mass consumption as well as mass production. You know, Henry Ford sees the lives of its workers, not just for the time in the factory, but also outside, and trying to create a system of mass consumption that goes along with this particular industry. And so one of the things that I'm interested in arguing about those early periods is the way in which this model of global Fordism is exported to the world, with an ideal of Detroit as the kind of manufacturing hub being put forth, but in a way that sort of asks the developing world to be patient, wait, hang on for a long, long period of time. If you're incredibly patient, you too can develop the industrial base that will allow you to be, you know, industrially productive in the same way that the U.S. or the European economies are. And one of the arguments that I make in the middle section of the book is that this notion of time of development kind of conceals a lot of the violence that goes along with the spread, the expansion of capitalism, that under the logic of patience is a kind of obscuring of the particularly blind nature of capitalism as it expands new markets.
And as the 50s turned into the 60s, and there was more and more decolonization, and there was also less and less patience with the arrangement of things. So how did the bank deal with the spread of these nationalist third world revolutions?
With contradictory and sort of tiptoeing logic, the first half of my book that traces the history that, you know, we've been talking about, and also the history through the 60s is told through a series of public documents, public speeches, brochures, pamphlets, and so forth, that try to get at the way in which the World Bank is sort of pitching itself to the world. And certainly in the 60s, when the membership triples effectively in about a 10-year span, mainly because of the decolonization of Africa and Asia, the World Bank finds itself in a scenario where it has to, at least in some ways, mollify the demands for more lending, lending at better rates, lending over longer terms that are coming from, you know, new nation states.
And this is when poverty as a word enters their discourse.
Exactly, yeah. Poverty alleviation becomes something of a mission statement in the 60s. It really is fully established under McNamara, but even in the prior reigns of George Woods and Eugene Black, you begin to see poverty kind of emerge. And the structural answer is that they produce an organization called the IDA, the International Development Association, that allows, sort of splits the world into rich and poor and offers some modest amount of lower rate, below rate market loans for the poorest countries that can be paid back over a longer period of time. But what's a tiny fraction of their lending becomes, in a way, the front piece of their public relations campaign. So that, you know, after the 1960s, the World Bank really identifies itself with this IDA-type lending, poverty alleviation, as its social mission.
And let's pause for a moment to reflect on the irony of Robert McNamara,
exactly,
the architect of the destruction of Indochina,
right,
as the man who is going to do a war on poverty. What about this twin discourse of development and war, which was also true of the U.S. domestically?
Yeah, and with Wolfowitz as well in a more recent incarnation. One thing that we should definitely point out is the inseparability between the World Bank and the U.S., especially in its early years, though certainly this has maintained to the present day, so that the kind of gentleman's agreement, and we saw this just a few months ago when Wolfowitz resigned or was sort of, resigned for him, is that the U.S. typically picks the World Bank president and Europe picks the IMF president. That deeply embedded relationship between U.S. foreign policy and the World Bank as an arm of U.S. foreign policy has been there from the outset.
And let's move rapidly ahead, since we're running low on time. What does your analysis offer to people who are fighting the World Bank and the model of development that it promotes?
One of the things that I've tried to do throughout the book is to sort of demystify the World Bank a bit, that it's not some kind of monolithic institution that announces its policies from on high and simply watches as the cards fall where they may, but rather that it's an institution that's been, since its inception, absolutely forced to respond to the pressures of its day, that it is a product of its historical moment, but also really subject to the social movement actors of its day. So I suggest that the IDA and its attempts to kind of contain the demands of third world nationalism in the 50s is really the product of the decolonizing social movements of that era. And I try to pull this forward into the present by looking at the social movements that are most directly kind of antagonists to the World Bank. And there's a final chapter on the World Social Forum, which I suggest is a kind of, conflicted, contradictory space, but nevertheless a space of possibility, and that the demands against the World Bank and the IMF, the Bretton Woods institutions, become a kind of interesting flashpoint for a critique of capitalism that I think has a lot of appeal and a lot of teeth to it at the moment.
That critique of capitalism, though, is often laced with a nostalgia for the kinds of Keynesian,
it is,
fantasized Keynesian world of several decades ago. Is there any point in making that nostalgic trip or not?
No, I mean, there's no point in making the nostalgic trip, and I think it needs to be as carefully clarified, the sentimentality that comes along with the reformist arguments of, you mentioned before Joseph Stiglitz, Amartya Sen. It seems to me that this won't get us very, very far. one of the interesting and sort of fundamental differences between the current moment and the radicalisms of the 40s and 50s is really the absence of an alternative framework, so that, you know, the world social forum imagines other worlds as are possible, and lots of kind of theoretical work about collectivities, multitudes, and so forth. Nevertheless, it's fairly clear that that the social movements of today are more likely to be making localized critical gestures against a particular form of capitalism or racism or sexism or something to that effect, rather than an argument about the totality of capitalism, the you know, overwhelming logic that moves back in a kind of classic Marxist sense from particularity to generalization. There's not the framework. There is no sort of actually existing socialism. There's no clear sense of another mode of production that I think, you know, really underpins a lot of the radicalism of the earlier part of the century.
But now there's some who would make a virtue of that
right.
lack, or the lack of a framework, or the vagueness, or the minimal nature of the agenda. Do you think that's a promising route?
Well, I take up that term minimum agenda in my final chapter, in part because it seems to me that we work from where we are. And, you know, if one is to mount...
even if where we are is not a very pretty place.
It's not a tremendously pretty place, though, it has certain kinds of optimisms as well. And one of the things that I'm concerned with in some of the kind of capital T theory theorizing on multitudes and commonalities and so forth, is the tendency to abandon politics, you know, on the ground in a way. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in trying to say is that minimum agendas are a starting point. We work from where we are, which is in a moment of, you know, sort of stark domination, hegemony of global capitalism, though with cracks showing, certainly.
All right, well, let's leave it on that promising note. All right, thanks.
One, can I add one quick thing, which is that coming a month or so from now in D.C., the World Bank IMF meetings are taking place. I think it's October 20th, maybe 19th, 20th, 21st. And there are going to be some substantial protests and workshops and so forth held in D.C. The 50 Years is Enough campaign has been organizing these, among others, and it's worth paying attention. And if, you know, listeners are in the area, it's worth going down to support those as a certain kind of minimum agenda.
Of course, now we're, 13 years after the founding of 50 Years is Enough.
Right.
So I guess it's 63 years.
63 years is plenty, right.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Brett.
And that was Brett Benjamin, professor of English at SUNY Albany and author of the book Invested Interest, Capital, Culture, and the World Bank, just out from the University of Minnesota Press. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Let's go out with this from a terrific new album called Kayla by MIA, which is basically Maya Arulprogasam. She's originally from Sri Lanka, where her father was a Marxist involved in the Tamil rebellion against the government. He was busted, and she and her mother fled to Britain. Maya has become part of an incredibly fertile cosmopolitan music scene. This is from Bamboo Banger, the first track on the album. Till next week, bye.